We next meet a man who calls the Central Coast his home, but whose art collection spans the globe. Stay tuned. Hi, this is Stephen DeLuque, and you are tuned in to Ears on Art, a twice-monthly program dedicated to the investigation and promotion of the visual arts. Ears on Art is produced in the studios of KCBX, serving Santa Barbara, San Luis Obispo, and Southern Monterey counties. For more information about the station, please visit the website at triwkcbx.org. In today's program, co-host Krissa Hewitt and I revisit the De Palma family of Morro Bay, Kathy and Doug. Last week, we focused on the art of Kathy De Palma and her upcoming show at the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art. But this afternoon, we turn our attention to Doug De Palma, who has traveled the globe for decades, amassing an impressive collection of art. We begin our visit in the living room of the De Palma home, which is filled with visual treasures. We are here visiting with last week's interviewee, Kathy De Palma. Hello again.
Hello. Nice to see you again.
And we have an extra special guest. And would you like to introduce him?
This is Douglas De Palma, and he's my husband.
Well, that seems to work out nicely. You have the same last name.
Yes, of course.
Doug, we are sitting in an absolutely fascinating room here. It is chock-a-block with artworks and sculptures and paintings and whatnot. And I understand that most of this is a result of your collection.
Well, I've bought art wherever I've lived, and I've lived many places in the world, although most of these things are from the Far East because the art there is so fascinating to me that I really went overboard when I was living there. The other things that I have are some paintings that I bought from local artists, but mostly what you see are things that I've collected living in Thailand, Japan, traveling in the Southeast Asia.
What got the bug to start buying and collecting art? Where did that come from?
Well, that's an interesting question. When I was a child, I read a lot, and I started saving and I buying books, and I was building a library, not knowing that I was going to end up with so many books, because I have around 3,000 books now. And along with books, I liked beautiful things around me. I was really engrossed in the cultures of Southeast Asia. And I like the Buddhist religion is one that I admire. The Buddhist people are the kindest, gentlest people I've seen anywhere. So their art projects that to me. It's very serene and very calm.
There's an amazing number of both three-dimensional and two-dimensional works just in this room. Which do you like better? Do you like the two-dimensional or the three-dimensional, or is there a preference?
I really don't have a preference. I think that the three-dimensional and a home are very interesting. There are a couple of paintings here that are tankas, really, that are art that's done in Tibet and Nepal. They are put on temples and outside of houses as kind of a flag. That's a tanka that you see over there, Imantaka, who's the lord of the underworld, and he has his devils and all underneath doing all kinds of obnoxious things to each other. And on top is Buddha and his disciples. So it's a juxtaposition of the two ideas. These are old tankas.
And what year was this when you were there collecting?
Well, that had to be around 1976, 77. I left Iran and made a long trip through India, Nepal. I wanted to go to Sri Lanka, but unfortunately, the king of Nepal had the airplane that would have taken me to Sri Lanka, and he was using it. That was the only airplane they had. And their beck and call was that one airplane that was used by the royal family. It was also their commercial aircraft. So
he pulled rank on you.
Yeah, he did. So I missed Sri Lanka on that trip. Coming back, I went to Japan again, which I'd lived in Japan for 2 years in 1954 to 56, I think it was. When I was in Japan, I was in the Air Force, and we were flying, and I would fly to all the places in the South Pacific. And I really like Malaysia, and I've been back as a traveler. In fact, I bought some of these things in Kuala Lumpur because there was a wonderful gallery at the hotel where I was staying, and I bought that big standing Buddha that you see there.
Which is a very impressive piece. It's about 5 feet tall.
And it's from Burma. Oh, the Buddha head that you see behind you over here. Yeah, that was from Thailand. It's illegal now to export Buddhas from Thailand. That was from Sukhothai, I believe, in Thailand, where why you see these Buddha heads, and people wonder, why do you just have the heads of the Buddha? Well, the Burmese fought the Thais in constant wars there a couple hundred years ago. What they would do, the Burmese would come in and they'd take over a capital like Sukhothai, and they would cut off the heads of the Buddhas. They would think that they might be hiding gold inside, and they were hunting for the gold that might be inside the Buddha. And so that's why you had all these heads that you see. That's because they were cut off in wars.
Doug, what took you to the two countries that you lived in?
I stayed in Japan for 2 years, from 1954 to 1956, as I was in the Air Force, and I had been commissioned, and I graduated from the flying school, and that was my first assignment, was to Japan. I lived in Thailand during the Vietnam War when I was sent over there to a fighter squadron.
It seems that the time frame for your pieces is quite extensive as well, because it's right behind me is a David Citino Scott piece,
yes,
which is a modern piece. And what are the ages of some of these things in the room?
Well, the Buddha over there is 17th century, and the two dolls you see over here on your right are 18th century Burmese dolls. What you see over there, that's a puppet from the island. That's from Bali.
How about the piece behind you? Isn't that really old, that little sculpture?
Oh, yes. Now, that is very old. This comes from a site in Thailand, Pimai, which was built by the architect who built Angkor Wat. So this predates Angkor Wat. And, of course, you couldn't get that out of the country today.
No. I think with most of the antiquities, especially in Southeast Asia, can't be removed from the countries at all.
No, they can't. And that piece you see over there is a head that's from, it's a small island in Malaysia, where it's the only island that is totally Buddhist.
How are you finding some of these things, or what has been the process of actually making purchases?
Well, the big piece and the others that I got from Malaysia, like the head back here, as I said, I bought in a hotel from a dealer who's a very nice man. Bargaining with these people, if you live there, you know, you really have to bargain. He had these high prices for these pieces, and I wasn't going to pay the prices he was asking me. I started bargaining with him and got the price down. My bid to him was at least half of what he was asking. We had a good rapport. He would have people who came into his shop who bought these things to bring back to the United States, for example, and make a big profit on them. I talked with him and let him know these were from me. I was going to have them in my home. So every year after that, I would get a postcard from him at Christmas, a very beautiful postcard with art objects on it. Mm-hmm. And because he knew I still had the pieces. The Buddhists in Southeast Asia don't believe that you can own a Buddhist piece. They feel that you're only borrowing it. When you die, somebody else will have it, and it's passed on, and it's not something that you own. All those little Buddhas that you see over in the display case, there's five or six shells of them, I bought at markets in Thailand, where they would sell these people. Their families would come in, and they'd had these things for years, and for one reason or the other, they wanted to get some money, and they would sell them. But they knew that they weren't selling them in the sense that we sell things. They were just getting money to let somebody else use them.
You're renting them for a while.
Yeah. And what you see above the door is a Garuda, and that is the national symbol of Malaysia, is the Garuda. The Garuda is from the epic poem that tells of the wars between humans and the evil gods. And It's depicted in Bangkok, and one temple has nothing but a series of paintings all around the walls that depict that epic. At any rate, the Garuda is what the warrior rides.
I believe the Garuda is very popular in Bali as well.
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, it is. It's because of the epic that's known throughout that region. What you see over there is a water pipe that I got in Iran that they actually used and can still be used today. They would have it in the little tea shops, and men would sit. As you can see, there's more than one hose there, so people would share it. And the vase you see over there is from Korea. That's done by a master pottery maker, and I bought that in a Korean government store.
And there's some lacquer boxes sitting on the coffee table, which look to be Russian.
They are. I got those in Moscow. The boxes all have fairy. They're all traditionally done with Russian fairy tale scenes, and then.
So you've traveled extensively.
Yes, I have. All my life, I started traveling when I was in my teens. I graduated from high school 6 months early. It was in a January. And rather than going on to junior college, and this was some time ago, obviously, because I'm 79 years old now, I just got up and I took a few things in a kind of a laundry bag, what they used to call laundry bags, that's what I had. I left Pasadena, California, and I spent around 3 months just traveling, hitchhiking across the United States and getting jobs as a dishwasher here and there.
So you've always had the bug.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
When you were also in the military, you lived in London, and you also lived in Germany for several years.
Yes, I did. I lived in London for 2 years. I lived in Germany for a year, also besides Vietnam and Japan and Thailand. And then when I was as a civilian, I lived in Iran for 2 years working for Hughes Aircraft Company. So all those places. And wherever I was able to travel to the places around. I wasn't just stuck there. So I saw all the places around. So I've seen all of Europe. I don't know if we mentioned it. I'm a dual Italian citizen. I got that through my father, who was born in Italy. And now Kathy's also a dual Italian citizen. So we have dual citizenship, which means we can travel there on our European Union passports. And you don't have any problem because you can go anywhere you want. You can live anywhere you want on that passport. It's a nice thing to have.
That's a really nice thing to have.
I am loving the story about the laundry bag and hitchhiking, because when my mother was maybe 20 or something, and she was born in 1907, so a little older than you, she hitchhiked with a friend from college along up and down the East Coast, and there are pictures with that same laundry bag over her shoulder. Obviously not yours, but probably a very similar ilk.
Yes, that's interesting to know. Of course, hitchhiking then was much simpler. Well, it was much safer. I don't think that hitchhiking today is as safe as it was at all, nor are you as accommodating. It was not a big problem, and it wasn't that hard to get picked up by somebody. And often it'd be somebody who was going a long distance. Mm-hmm. As I remember, one ride I had was all the way from somewhere north of Fresno, I believe, all the way through Colorado. So that's a long ways to go on a single ride. Let's see, that was back in the 40s. That was in the late 40s. So
it was still safe up until the mid-70s, because I used to hitchhike all the time when I was in high school and in college. And I remember one time I was in the Central Valley, and a Rolls Royce stopped and picked me up. And that was like, what are you doing? It was a short ride. It was only for 40 miles, but that's okay.
Yeah, that's true. Hitchhiking around the world is different. You see people hitchhiking in Europe, but not that much anymore. I remember I was in Croatia and Dubrovnik, and I had a rental car, and I was going from Dubrovnik to down the coast, and we picked up a couple of soldiers who were hitchhiking.
You are listening to Ears on Art, a program focusing on the visual arts, produced at the studios of KCBX Public Radio in San Luis Obispo on California's Central Coast. Today's guest is Doug DePalma, world traveler and collector of art from around the globe. Doug now relates a personal anecdote about a purchase he and his late wife made at a local exhibit of works by David Citino Scott. The exhibit consisted of busts of both Asian and American immolation victims who had set themselves aflame in protest to the American policies during the Vietnam conflict.
That's that story. You were asking about David Citino Scott's monk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's from his show of monks that he had at, well, he's had it several times, but it was first done at the San Luis. Are you familiar with the show?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think it was probably the most powerful show ever presented at what is now the museum.
Yes, and it's been wherever he's had that, it's been. And I thought, when I saw this piece, I was with my first wife, who was deceased. We looked at it, and I said, you know, we should buy that. And she wanted to buy it, too. And it was rather expensive, but we really wanted it. So we bought it, and when we got home, we talked to each other. I said, I wonder what it was that motivated us to buy that. I mean, it's Oriental art, but it's not really. It's a depiction of something else. It made us remember, because this happened back in 1973. We were living in Washington, D.C., and I had a cousin, George Winnie Jr., who was going to University of California in San Diego at the time. And he was violently opposed to the Vietnam War, which I had just come back from. And I was living in Washington, D.C. And we talked about it. Didn't want to be drafted. Didn't want to serve. And he wasn't going to go to Canada. And so we were sitting listening to the news, and Walter Cronkite was the newsman we were listening to. And he suddenly announced that a student at the University of California, San Diego, had immolated himself. And his name was George M. Winnie Jr. And we didn't know anything. That's how we found out that this had happened. It's interesting because now in our today's world, there are a couple of filmmakers in Hollywood who are trying to do a documentary on the subject matter is the Americans who self-immolated, mm-hmm. Rather than, you know, we all know about the monks who did this, but there are a number of Americans, not a number, but there, I forget how many, I think there's 7 or 8 Americans who self-immolated. They wanted to do a documentary on that, and they chose, in doing their research, George Winnie, my cousin, was the one that they could find, that they could see had a history that they could sort of go after. And they had a living relative, which was me, and the others didn't. So they decided to do their documentary and center it on George Winnie Jr. And they got a hold of David Scott, and because of his show, and they visited him, and then he told them, he says, you know, his cousin lives in Morro Bay and owns one of my monks. And so that's how they contacted me, and I agreed to be in their documentary. And they're still working on it, and they've spent 2 very long sessions here where they filmed in interviews with me. So it'll be interesting to see how that comes out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I knew that there were at least 5 immolation victims in the United States that had joined the protest of the monks in Vietnam. It's quite unusual to meet the cousin of one.
Yes, yes. And several people who were peripherally involved with that self-immolation live in this area. So they were able to interview them also. There's one man is a retired physics professor from Cal Poly, and he was the one who tried to put out the flames and got badly burned when Chip did this. And he lives in Los Osos, and so they were able to interview him.
It's interesting your personal historical ties to the artwork that you've collected and your explanations as to why you collected them, because we don't often get to hear that when we look at collections. We just see, well, here's a bunch of stuff somebody put together, and there it is. And this has been really, really entertaining and amazingly educational.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to share it with you.
I should also mention that there are some pieces here of Kathy's.
Yes. Yeah, I'm also in his collection.
I'm not going to ask in which manner.
He has some of my mermaids. He has the Moroccan mermaid and one that's called the Mermaid in the Shinto Shrine, and that one actually fits the collection the best. And then I did a couple of pieces for him. I did an Adam and Eve with the serpent, and then I did a version of Starry Night, which is Van Gogh's bedroom, which he has.
Terrific. So.
And when you travel together, have you often come home with something new for the collection, maybe of the central theme that we've been talking about here, but maybe from a whole different part of the world?
Well, when Doug and I met, we each had very large art collections. He had the collection you're looking at now, and I had a large collection of Arnie Nybak's paintings and a lot of David Gurney's ceramics and a huge collection of Guatemalan and Chinese textiles and a lot of other craft items from my days at the Scarlet Palette. And we almost have a rule that we don't collect anymore, because I had to get rid of a lot of my collection, you know, just to make the move from San Luis out here. And his collection is pretty, what should I say? I don't think he has room for much more. I don't know, what's your version of the collecting?
No, that's true. We sort of made a pact that we weren't going to just go buying things because we wanted to travel, and we traveled a lot and gone a lot of places, and we bought a few things, but just art, you know.
Not art.
Not really art. We bought a couple of small objects when we were in Shanghai, but nothing of significance. So no, our days of buying large pieces of art are over. What we have is what we have.
Uh-huh. Yeah, our rule is that if it can easily fit in a suitcase without causing too much trouble, then possibly.
That's a good way to do it.
Well, it's the same with clothes, because you can go overboard with clothes and you can't get those back either.
That's right.
When you run out of wall space, you just figure out something else, maybe. But I've said before, I have such a hard time just rotating stuff out, because what's there, I really like.
Yes.
And was bought for a reason. So.
Yes, that's how I feel. With books, it's difficult. I have to stop buying books. I have more books than I've filled up all my bookcases, and I have bookcases in my office in the back too that are full, and then I don't know if you've seen, but I have bookcases out here that are full, plus the library here that's full.
And a lot of chairs that are full with stacks.
Yeah. But
sounds like my house.
I was told, I hadn't seen it, but Margaret Nybak was a friend of mine in the sense she had a bookstore in San Luis, and I used to spend a lot of time over there. And we talk about books, and I bought some things from her. But she was a person who had to have books, too. But in her home, they'd just be piled up on the floor. She had so many books everywhere. And I tried to avoid that, although my office in the back has a few piles of books. Mm-hmm. But if you're used to buying books and I read... And if it's a book I really, you know, I really like, I want to have it, because if I bothered going through it, I'll probably go back to it again. So I do go back to my books often.
I was just wondering if there is any kind of theme to the book collection, or is it fairly eclectic?
Well. There isn't a theme. Books are books. They're divided into fiction biography, travel books, art books. So those are the kinds of books that I collect in those categories. I'm sensitive to the age of books, and I'm sensitive to books that have value. And once in a while, I'll find a, not so much anymore, but I used to be able to find in a bookstore, I come across a book that was really fairly valuable that I could get for nothing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, first editions, for example, of authors. So I do have a number of first editions of William Faulkner, for example. I have several of Hemingway, and I have first editions of T.S. Eliot. And I have one of the oldest books that there are. They called them Incunabula, and these are the first books that were printed in Italy, in Venice. And that was the first books actually printed, and they weren't bound. You'd have to, what they would do, a person would buy the book, they'd go around and they'd pick up the pages, or they weren't pages, they were generally little folios of it. There may have been 10 of them. And they'd pick those up and buy them. And then they'd go to a binder, and they'd have them put in a very nice binding. And I have one of those Incunabula that was printed in 1475, something like that. But it's one of the earliest books that we have. And you know, if I find something that if I can get something like that, you know, I will. Oh, James Joyce. I have some first editions of James Joyce, and I have one signed by James Joyce. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of a star thing in my collection.
Well, again, this has just been the most educational and wonderful experience. This room is so full of history and artwork and the books and everything. It's just really an amazing place to be. Thank you so very much for spending an evening with us.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
And Kathy, thank you, and looking forward to your show.
Thank you. I hope you'll come to the show.
Co-host Krista Hewitt and I would like to thank this month's guests, Kathy and Doug DePalma. Kathy's show opens on March 2nd in the McMean Gallery upstairs at the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art, located at the southern end of the Mission Plaza in downtown San Luis Obispo. For information on this show and other upcoming events, visit their website at triwsloma.org. And in a special note, Krista and I would also like to thank Kathy and Doug for their gracious hospitality as they had prepared a sumptuous feast for us after the interview. A very lovely touch to a fascinating and educational evening. The Phantom Project is still going strong through the end of this month. Please join this guerrilla gallery at 672 Higuera Street in downtown San Luis Obispo, just down from Tom's Toys. The hours of operation are Thursday from 2 until 8 p.m. and Friday through Sunday from 1 until 5 p.m. The show runs through March 2nd. And don't forget, Pledge Drive is on the way, so be sure to let thy wallet speak. This is Stephen DeLuque, and for co-host Krista Hewitt, we thank you so very much for listening.